KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, April 20th, 2006, for broadcast at this time. On today's program, we'll hear a discussion between Douglas County Sheriff Tim Dunning and Legal Director for the Nebraska ACLU, Amy Miller. Their topic will be Where Sex Offenders Can and Cannot Live. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Press Club, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
A new law, new Iowa law, is added to an already growing population of sex offenders in Douglas County. The law says sex offenders who victimize minors cannot live within 2,000 feet of a school or child care center. Is the law doing any good? In 2005, the Omaha City Law Department cautioned the City Council that a sex offender still has property rights under state and federal law. But numerous communities, including Papillion, Springfield, and South Sioux City, Nebraska, have passed sex offender registry laws restricting where they can live. Amy Miller, Legal Director for the American Civil Liberties Union, and Tim Dunning, Douglas County Sheriff, are here to share some facts on this topic. Amy Miller is Legal Director for ACLU Nebraska, the state affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union. A native Nebraskan, she attended Grinnell College in Iowa for her BA and then returned to the University of Nebraska at Lincoln for law school. She has practiced law since 1996, and she has worked for the ACLU since 1999. As legal director, she is responsible for managing legal programs as well as some of the legislative lobbying and public education work of her organization. ACLU Nebraska is a nonprofit group that works to protect and promote civil liberties and constitutional rights for all. Tim Dunning, Douglas County Sheriff, has been sheriff since 1994. He is retired from the Omaha Police Department after 22 years of service. Tim has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a master's degree in public administration from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He is a graduate of the FBI National Academy and a graduate of the FBI Executive Development Institute. At this time, I'd like to welcome Sheriff Dunning.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me. This is my first of one of these forums, so I'm not sure what the protocol is, so if I'm going off the wrong direction, let me know, and I'm sure somebody will. From my side of it, the enforcement side of the Sex Offender Registry, I want to cover a little bit about what we do and then get into some suggestions that I made to the Nebraska legislature in this past session and maybe offer some opinions as to where I think that we should be going from there. The sheriffs of all the 93 counties have statutory authority for registering and monitoring sex offenders. Sex offenders have, after their adjudication or after their incarceration, they have a set amount of days that they need to get to their sheriff, make that registration, and in that registration process, we photograph, we fingerprint, we get basic demographic information, so we hopefully we know where they are at all times. And as they are a proven nonconformist group, that's always kind of a challenge. Once we receive that information, we pass that information on within 5 days to the Nebraska State Patrol, which is the central repository for all of that information. They then classify, and they classify into levels one, levels two, levels three sex offenders, and I think probably we would agree that we're predominantly talking about level three sex offenders, because this is the group that we're most, the communities have the most concern about. And so how do we go about monitoring these folks? Currently in Douglas County we have 614 sex offenders. About 262 of these folks are of the level three category. We make home visits, periodically make home visits to make sure that they're living where they said they're going to live. And while we're at these home visits, we try and note whether there are children in close proximity. A lot of times sex offenders will hook up with a female, for example, that's suffering from hard economic times, and all of a sudden They're living with this individual, and lo and behold, she may have some children, and it's just a matter of time before the potential for having another sexual abuse case may occur. So we try and note all of those sorts of things. While we're making these home visits, we have somewhat of a zero tolerance. I don't want to say somewhat. We have a zero tolerance policy for those that don't correspond to the sex offender laws. If they're not living where they say they are, if it's, you know, a day or two, we're certainly going to just re-register and go on from there. But if it's a flagrant violation where they haven't re-registered for a period of time, then we'll take the next step of getting a felony arrest and or a felony warrant, excuse me, and making that arrest. One of the problems with the warrant process and the monitoring and tracking of sex offenders is that a lot of the sex offenders are transients. So they get out of court or they get out of prison, and their first stop is the St. Francis House or the Open Door Mission, and they're only allowed to stay there for a couple of weeks, and then once they leave there, the next home is maybe under the 42nd Street Bridge. And so the registering and monitoring is difficult because they don't have transportation, obviously. Otherwise, they wouldn't be living in those kinds of conditions. So the transient population is a real problem for us. Another tactic that we use, the State Patrol sends out a reminder card once a year that goes to the home where the person says they're living. And in that reminder card, they ask whoever the occupants of that house are that if ex-sex offender is not living there, please forward that information so that the county sheriff can be notified and they can go out and try and find that individual. Well, we've taken that a step further. We correspond that with two additional mail-outs that are different than the times that the State Patrol does their mailing, and that's been very successful for us. We generally, on average, we'll find maybe 7 violations a week. And so, again, if it's a short period of time, we get them re-registered. If it's a flagrant violation, we get a felony warrant. We review on a daily basis field interrogation cards. These are the cards that are made by law enforcement officers on a daily basis as to people they come in contact with on radio calls, traffic stops, accidents, and so on. And sometimes there we'll find our sex offenders on these cards, and maybe they've given a different address, so we need to go out and do some follow-up and find out where they're at. The last thing that's we've actually did it on an informal basis, and now we're formalizing it. We thought it would be very useful to use global information systems in tracking sex offenders. So some time ago, we developed using ArcView and GIS mapping software, making a map. And on the map, we have the cruiser officer can go to an icon, simply put the cursor on the icon, up pops up the name and level of threat level of the sex offender, and then we went back in and we populated the map with schools, daycare centers, playgrounds, or any other known locations where children might congregate. And that's helpful for us. We've now placed that in our cruisers. We have, I think we're up to about 20 cruisers now that we have that in, and we're trying to work out the bugs of the system. The real-time data entry has been our biggest challenge right now. The ideal situation we hope to get into is that once the State Patrol makes their classification, they would be able to real-time send that information to us so that it would automatically download onto our laptops. And so once we have that, While the officers, deputies, troopers are on the street and they come in contact with missing children, sexual assault calls, that sort of thing, they'll know at least who maybe they probably ought to be taking a look at first. So we hope that'll be real helpful. And once we work out the bugs, as I said, we're going to offer that software to all the law enforcement agencies in Douglas County, and hopefully it'll take off and go into Pot County and Sarpy County and so on. I guess what we're here for today is to talk about the debate about where sex offenders ought to be living, the restrictions that we constantly hear, and I guess from watching this whole thing evolve, what I've seen is a community, number one, Iowa, enacted their law, Council Bluffs. They made the restrictions so restrictive that because of the proximity of schools and daycare centers and playgrounds in Council Bluffs, people could virtually not live there. And so the biggest fear for law enforcement, and I don't think I share this alone because I've talked to a number of other sheriffs, they feel the same concern, is that once you restrict someone to the point where they're not going to be able to live somewhere, the possibility of them going underground and then you having a real detection problem is very real, and we're very afraid of that. And we've found that shortly after September 2005, when the Iowa law was enacted, we immediately came across about 28 individuals that came here, registered, but what happened to the rest? And so you have an underground situation. Now, maybe somebody's going to be detected, and they say, well, you know, you're not supposed to be living in this location, so now they're going to move for a second time. That person has a potential for going underground. So we have a problem with that. What we were hoping that would happen out of this legislative session, and some of it did happen, is that we were hoping that electronic monitoring of Level 3 sex offenders would occur, and it looks like I haven't read the bill in its entirety or had our county attorney's office examine it thoroughly for us yet, but it looks like that's probably a possibility. So we've had that capability for some time. We've used it for some time on drunk drivers. We've used it for some time on federal parolees. Why not use it on the Level 3 sex offenders so that we know where they are at all times? The second thing that I was hoping that would come out of this legislative session, and I think part of it did, but I'm not sure all of it did, was that we need to have mandatory treatment upon conviction. And I guess you would say, well, you know, you really can't treat me if I don't accept that I need to be treated, and that's probably a true premise. However, I'm a thorough believer that if you have no treatment, then nothing will happen. You know, we frequently put people in jail if you look at our Douglas County Jail, for instance, everybody is in there for probably one of five things. They either have a gambling problem, they have an alcohol problem, they have a drug problem, they have a mental illness, or they're poor and they commit crime to live. And so if you would believe in that premise, treatment for any one of those individuals might help that recidivism rate. You take, just to give a couple of examples, the David Burdett sex offender we had back in the early 1980s. David Burdett had sexually assaulted some women. He had profiled what was, I believe, the 10 best-looking women or best-dressed women in Omaha, and he went one by one down the line until law enforcement was able to figure out the profile, arrested him, convicted him, sent him to prison. Receives no treatment while he's there because he fails to acknowledge that he has a problem. Released from prison about 1997 or 98, then begins profiling women who were recently widowed and began profiling the obituary for his victims. Once we figured that scenario out, we again caught him in the act, arrested him, sent him back to prison. I think he's doing a habitual sentence right now, but again, failing to acknowledge that he has a problem, is not having any treatment. Dr. Schrein from Little Vikes football from several years ago, same type of thing, probably behavior that was going on for years, finally caught, went to prison, did not acknowledge that he had a problem, and now Dr. Schrein is out, and I'm not sure where he is now. I think he might be in a foreign country or something. So mandatory treatment, I think, is very important. Those that are officially labeled sexual sociopaths, I have a firm belief that they are not curable and should never be released into society. So if that's the case, maybe they shouldn't be going to prison in the first place. Maybe they should be going directly to a mental institution. Or if they do go to prison, they should be going to a mental institution upon that release. Eliminate the 10-year cap. Currently, there's a 10-year cap that if you don't reoffend as a sex offender, you can be taken off that list. I don't know that Level 3s ought to ever be taken off that list. And then to correspond with that statement, I think, and this was the one thing that didn't come out of this legislative session that I was hoping would, is there needs to be a redefinition of the term sex offender. I mean, I think we've placed everybody into that category. In casual conversation, everybody says the word sex offender, and you automatically think the worst of the worst, and a Level 1 might not be the worst of the worst. That might be the 17-year-old kid that got his 16-year-old girlfriend pregnant, and they called it a statutory rape, and that person becomes a sex offender. Totally different type of individual than a sexual sociopath. That person might not ever reoffend. They may have been consulting parties at that particular time. So there, I believe there needs to be a redefinition of what sex offenders are. That's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have, or did you want to wait for another term?
Right.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Amy Miller, and it's a pleasure to take a stand right after a sheriff and be able to say the ACLU and a sheriff don't necessarily disagree on all the points on an issue. You're going to find out that we do have some significant disagreements, but I think Sheriff Dunning did point out some of the great weaknesses and some of the problems that we've seen have happened as a result of Iowa's very restrictive state law defining where sex offenders can and can't live. It's important in Nebraska right now because, as Sheriff Dunning pointed out, we just signed into law in this state on April 13th a new law that allows local municipalities to pass residency restrictions for Level 3 sex offenders only. That would be Level 3, only the most dangerous individuals, and only those whose offenses were against someone who was 18 years or younger. So unlike Iowa, where all sex offenders, regardless of the nature of their crime, as Sheriff Dunning pointed out, the individual who's convicted after having had consensual sex with a underage girlfriend or boyfriend, Iowa's affected all people who ended up on the sex offender registry. Nebraska did limit it only to those most dangerous individuals who have offended against a child. But the problem is that by allowing local municipalities to have that sort of power to restrict where individuals can live, we are still going to create the same sort of effect that Iowa's had both in its state and the spillover effect in Nebraska. The Nebraska law now says that no local municipality or county can pass a law that that it exceeds the 500-foot restriction. This is important because immediately after the Iowa law went into effect, many Nebraska municipalities, including South Sioux City, Dakota City, Wayne, Utan, Ashland, Springfield, Gretna, Papillion, and more, passed local laws that mimicked the Iowa law. There were 2,000-foot restrictions restricting anyone from living within a child care center, a school, a registered babysitter, a library, a school park, a bus stop, and literally crossed off the map for most people the ability to live in any municipality other than, say, Omaha or Lincoln. Now, those expansive laws now under the state law that just passed have been declared void, and that no city is able to make a restriction more than that 500-foot restriction. And obviously, what's driving the rush to pass these laws are three ideas or concepts about sex offenders that are sort of commonly held in our society. One is the belief that sex offenders can't be treated or cured in any way, shape, or form, that they just are always going to be recidivizing offenders. Two, the belief that there is a very high recidivism rate among sex offenders, more so than other types of criminals. And three, because we have this specter of the very high-profile type crimes that have happened where a stranger lurks, decides to target a child, and then abducts, murders, and rapes that child. But the facts indicate that all three of those beliefs that are driving the sex offender debate are, in fact, myths. It's true that early studies said sex offenders aren't curable, but for the last decade, the psychiatric and therapeutic communities have been telling us that treatment does work, and that's where you're going to see Sheriff Dunning and I agreeing wholeheartedly. Treatment is very effective for some sex offenders. The majority of sex offenders with treatment will not reoffend. It's a behavioral disorder that they come to grips with, and with sustained mandatory treatment, those individuals can control their behavior. In fact, the U.S. Department of Justice has also said that the recidivism levels are not as high as we believe. That, again, there's this belief that all sex offenders, once a sex offender, always a sex offender, but it depends on whether or not that offender has been in treatment or not. Individuals who've not had treatment are likely to reoffend. Those who have been in treatment are not likely to reoffend. A 2003 study from one of our own University of Nebraska at Omaha criminal justice professors found that other non-sex offense criminals actually reoffend more frequently than sex offenders. That is, murderers, kidnappers, people who engage in physical assaults, people who engage in burglary or robbery are more likely to reoffend than a sex offender. The myth that sex offenders are the highest reoccurring offenses simply is a myth. And finally, the myth of strangers lurking in the bushes seeking to abduct children is also sadly a myth. The United States Department of Justice statistics show that 80 to 90% of children who are sexually molested were raped by someone who knew them, a family member or someone who's a close family friend or someone who actually lives in the household. That means that restricting the residency of individuals that you don't know doesn't protect you from the people around your dining room table. So if treatment can help and the threat isn't from strangers in the community, why have these restrictions on where sex offenders can live? Why limit certain places where individuals can live and others where they can't? unfortunately, it appears to be entirely a fear-driven, myth-driven set of laws. There's simply no credible evidence that these laws create safety. On the contrary, it appears that these laws create problems, as Sheriff Dunning pointed out, by driving people underground, interrupting treatment. Sex offenders are absconding at astronomical rates for the first time since we've had the sex offender registry across the country. In Iowa, since their law went into effect, the number of people who have gone missing from the sex offender registry has tripled. Tripled the number of people who have simply disappeared off the radar so that we can't monitor them, so we can't find out whether they're doing treatment or not. By interrupting the treatment or stopping it altogether, of course, you fall right back into that set of statistics that said without treatment, sex offenders are likely to reoffend. We have the problem that scarce law enforcement resources are being expended on following up on where sex offenders are now living, checking to see whether they're in compliance. One of the sheriffs in Iowa who was interviewed after their law went into effect said that they have two deputies who spend over half their time in that county alone simply dealing with sex offender issues, which pulls them away from other legal issues and public safety issues that we need them to be dealing with. It's also a problem because Iowa prosecutors have reported that the sex offender residency restrictions are affecting their ability to prosecute new sex offenders. People are less likely to confess or to enter into a plea agreement if they're aware of the fact that, in fact, they will have to turn around and face not only conviction, not only registering on a sex offender registry and being on a website, but also face restrictions on where they can live in the future. That's particularly problematic when you're talking about crimes involving children, especially when it's a child victim. It's very, very difficult sometimes to go to trial in those cases. Sometimes it's the problem of the evidence. Sometimes it's a problem that the child is simply too young. And sometimes the problem is you don't want to re-traumatize the victim by asking them to testify again. And that's why plea agreements and confessions are so important. The overflow effect on sex offenders can't be set aside. Obviously, the problem, of course, is to talk about the issue of how it affects sex offenders' families makes you sound like a liberal who comes from the ACLU. But the problem is that it doesn't just affect the sex offenders. Sex offenders who have rehabilitated, moved back, taken up a new life, married, had children, or moved in with their family members, there's an overflow effect on those people too. Sex offenders who can't live within an X number of feet of a school sometimes have children who now don't live as close to the school that they want to attend. It uproots those families, disrupts their employment, disrupts their ability to access schools. And not surprisingly, studies seem to be indicating that that also can recontribute to stress factors that put them back into a cycle of reoffending. Who has studied the ineffectiveness of sex offender residency restrictions? Is it a bunch of crazy liberals from the ACLU who have been coming up with these statistics? It is not. It's the Colorado State Department of Public Safety. They found sex offenders who recommitted new crimes weren't living next to schools or daycare facilities. The Colorado State Department of Public Safety said, in fact, sex offenders were scattered throughout the geographical areas, and there was no correlation between where they lived and whether or not they reoffended. The Minnesota Department of Corrections in 2003 found that proximity of residency was, again, not a factor in any sex offenders. To the contrary, sex offenders were more likely to travel to a place where they were not known to anyone in order to choose a new victim. And as I said before, the United States Department of Justice, not a bastion of liberalism, has found there is no higher recidivism rate among sex offenders in comparison to other violent crimes. And the voices of criticism that are being heard of these residency restrictions are also those that might surprise you. The prosecutors are speaking out against it. The Iowa County Attorneys Association, in fact, has petitioned the state legislature in Iowa to go back and change the law because it's having too damaging an impact on their ability to prosecute people. Law enforcement have disagreed with it. Sheriffs in Iowa are saying they're spending too much time, too much resources trying to track down monitoring and compliance of these issues. And victims advocates are saying this is not the way to go. Both the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the Nebraska Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault have both criticized the law because it's not effective and doesn't help provide safety in the community. So what do we need instead of residency restrictions? I'm not an expert in these fields, so I had to go and look what the experts say, what victims advocates, what prosecutors and law enforcement are saying. And there's three methods that they're talking about for residency for effective monitoring of sex offenders and preventing future sex offenses. One, we need to educate children at home, in the public schools, in their worship places and community centers. We need to continue to educate children on how to handle a situation that might arise where they might be approached by someone. Two, we need to educate parents. especially because the message that's being given by the sex offender websites, by residency restrictions, the public message is there are bad people out there that you don't know. Here's their picture, or here they live in a different place. You'll be safe if you just check the website, if you just make sure no one's living. That creates a false sense of security for parents. Parents need to be aware of the fact that it's more likely that the boyfriend or girlfriend that is living with them in the home, or the next-door neighbor who has befriended their family and said, oh, why don't you send your kid over to play with me? Parents need to be educated that the real offenders are 90% likely to be someone they know. And three, we need to educate bystanders. All of us, as members of the public, should be aware of what sort of behavior to be looking out for, how to report suspected sex offender activity, how we can be helping to intervene if we see something that looks problematic. In other words, we're not going to have safe communities unless we continue to provide treatment and monitoring, another point that Sheriff Dunning and I definitely agree on. And residency restrictions are having the exact opposite effect of what they have been promised to do. Unfortunately, what we're looking at with Nebraska having given the go-ahead to local municipalities to pass these laws is we're going to have continuing problems in Nebraska as we deal with the overflow effect from Iowa and the own results from our own poor public policy choices. I think we're ready to take questions.
Okay, at this time, there's paper and pencil on the tables, and if you'd like to write down any questions that you may have, and they'll be brought to the table, please. Thank you. Okay, the first one is for Sheriff Dunning. So you don't favor laws restricting where sex offenders can live. Do you agree that so much reoffending by sex offenders is a myth?
Well, as I've stated previously, I'm just not a proponent of residency restrictions. I think that's a feel-good legislation that really has no impact. I would, again, rather to see the monitoring systems take place as opposed to that. There'll never be a law found to be constitutional that'll say that I can't fly by a school, drive by a school, or walk by a school, or walk slowly by a school. So if all those things could take place, then the restriction that you can't live within so many feet of a school is really kind of a joke. It's as simple as that.
Amy, this is for you. One of the reasons for the new laws dealing with sex offenders is because so many of them reoffend. Do you know of any treatment options that do a better job of helping offenders control their urges?
Yeah, again, I think that the statistics show from the Department of Justice, from the United States Department of Justice, that treatment can be effective. The question is then what type of treatment is effective. Some states have looked into really extreme laws, which I think are probably unconstitutional, including, for example, chemical castration of sex offenders. And I think it's just clear that once those reach an upper level of judicial review, those will be found to be unconstitutional. Apparently, from my reading, those who treat sex offenders indicate that it's just behavior modification, that individuals who fall into the two different categories, if you have a sexual sociopath, those, as Sheriff Dunning pointed out, may not be individuals whose treatment can be modified unless they remain in custody for the rest of their lives. But for those people who simply have engaged in behavior that was not appropriate, can be modified with appropriate treatment, with enough counseling to show them the impact that their actions have on their victims. One of the websites that I looked at from the American Psychological Association compared some sex offender behavior to extramarital behavior by married people, that you may still have those urges, but you can control the urge to engage in inappropriate sexual behavior outside of the marital bond once you realize how that might impact your relationships, how that impacts the people that you engage with. So, as I understand, ongoing treatment and therapy is successful, and that's simply the same type of behavior modification that you see with other types of counseling.
Sheriff Dunning, do you think the current tracking system is effective? Is that the reason why residency restrictions are gaining favor?
Well, I don't think people have given the tracking systems enough time. We just were recently, by this legislative session, given the ability to use tracking systems. You know, unless someone was sentenced by the court to be monitored by electronic inmate monitoring type systems, that did not occur. So I think there's been some language in this particular statute, I believe, that's going to give some teeth to that. And with that, I think the group that we're the most afraid of, the level three sex offenders, I think we'll be able to adequately monitor them because there's no reason not to know where they are at all times, just as we've done with drunk driving convictions for some time.
Amy, assuming a community has no sex offender registration law, do you have a problem with the news media printing or broadcasting where the offender lives?
This, I think, is one of those interesting intersections of different constitutional rights. Obviously, the press has a right to publish information that is accurate and true and contained in a public record. For example, the sex offender registry information, even if we didn't have a website, you still may be able to find out the name of an individual by going and looking at a court record that would be public record. The problem, of course, is the way that we've seen across the country and even in our own state, retaliation against people who are on the sex offender registries who have been convicted of a sex offender crime. Two men were murdered in Washington just a couple months ago, Washington State, as an individual who posed as an FBI officer came to their house to tell them that he needed to inspect the home, make sure they were in compliance with sex offender regulations, then murdered both of them. And he had obtained that information from the city records that were published by a local newspaper. In Maine, obviously, we also just had another similar murder. And in Nebraska, when our sex offender registries first went up and made public the names and addresses of individuals, we had a number of ugly incidents where no one was killed, but there was threats of death and rioting outside of some of the homes of individuals who were on the sex offender registry. So the conflict is, of course, the press does have the right to print information that's accurate and in the public record. The problem is that having these sex offender registries, by having the website, by having the sort of public attention drawn to the issue, has incited some other bad individuals to very extreme behavior.
In Ralston, there's only something like 4 to 6 sex offenders in a city populated with thousands of people. Is this as big a problem as it makes out to be, or is it just media hype or fear?
Sheriff Dunn. Well, I guess that's a hard question to answer because there's really not a lot of information there. I'm not sure where they live. I'm not really sure how to respond to that. I just think that having monitoring systems is a lot better way to go, so I know where they're going to be because, you're just not going to make somebody move too many times before they're just not going to report. They're just going to go underground, and then that's a real problem for law enforcement because I have no idea where you are. I would think knowing who a sex offender is in a small community. I know I just recently heard, I think it was Mike McKnight was telling me that there's one sex offender in the city of Papillion, and he's got a Jerry Brown's for sheriff sign in his yard, so I thought that was kind of comical. But I guess in a small town setting, I guess you're going to know. With the sex offender registry, all you simply need to do is put in your zip code, and you can find out what sex offenders live in what proximity to your address. I think there is all kinds of awareness systems that are out there that should be sufficient. I'm afraid as these communities go, and it's going to continue because it's going to be politically unwise for somebody on a city council or a mayor of a small town to say no because it'll be deemed un-American. So I have a real fear for that, but I don't think the residency restriction is I just don't think that solves anything.
And I'll just add to that Ralston is not alone in being fearful, despite the fact they only have, I think the figure was 4 to 6 sex offenders. Some of the small municipalities, the names of which I can't keep in mind at this point, that have passed sex offender residency restrictions, not only don't have a sex offender in their town, they don't have a sex offender in the county. But they pass the laws as a prophylactic, preemptive strike, again, because it's politically expedient. And the difficulty, of course, is that while that may give the appearance of comfort, we still do not have any greater amount of safety. Proximity to where you live and where your offense is going to occur simply has no scientific basis in any of the studies that have been done. And it's particularly problematic when you think about the fact that even the Nebraska state law, which, as you can tell, we disagree with, only affects level 3 offenders. Those are individuals who the Nebraska State Patrol's reviewing of their record have decided are the most dangerous. There are level one and level two sex offenders and people who've never been convicted of a sex crime who live among us. And we have created an atmosphere of false security by suggesting as long as you've checked your website or your town has passed an ordinance, you're safe. That's simply not true. And you cannot substitute actual safety measures for this something as serious as this.
What signs or behavior are we, the public, looking for? Studies have shown inconsistent behavior. How do we know if it's bad behavior or if it's completely innocent?
Good question. And the fact that I'm not going to be able to answer it effectively shows we need more public education on this. The little bit of studying that I've done in preparation for the ACLU's response to the legislature's effort to pass residency restrictions indicated that there is a model out there that some communities have adopted for passing public education efforts so that bystanders, family members, school teachers, people in the professions that have contact with children would be able to recognize warning signs for children that might have in fact been the victim already of a molestation, or also for identifying adult behavior that's suspect. But as I stand here with some knowledge about sex offender behavior, I can't tell you what those are because we don't have a consistent program of public education, something that we all could individually go out and try to do, but it would be nice if, in fact, we had more state resources being devoted to a public education campaign to keep people safe as opposed to simply residency restrictions.
Okay, and kind of a follow-up on that, this is a question for Sheriff Dunning. What are you doing to educate the parents and families on sex offenders?
Not enough. Don't really have a great answer to that other than, we do have programs where we go into the grade schools and it probably follows through with our DARE officers that go into the schools and we talk about stranger danger and that sort of thing. There are some models for that, Patch the Pony and those sorts of programs. But I would agree with the ACLU that that is an area that we're very lacking in or probably needs to be a better awareness level, not only for the kids, but for the parents and for bystanders. I made note of that. I'm going to include that in my next presentation, as a matter of fact, because that is an area that we're very lacking in and probably should be some money from the legislature placed towards that so that some standardized program for all law enforcement in the area can be created.
This is the question for both. Are there any restrictions or examples of sex offenders changing their names?
Interestingly, anyone who wants to change their name has to go through a court procedure to change their name, and you have to publish public notice of that. So if I decided to change my name to Boom Boom tomorrow, I in fact would have to take out a legal notice in a public newspaper, ask the judicial permission before I could change my name. And indeed, if I was a sex offender, that public notice would have to also go to law enforcement. Sex offenders, regardless of what level they're at in Nebraska, have to notify any significant change to law enforcement, ranging from when they move, even prior to these residency restrictions, they had to keep up with where they lived, where they worked, name changes, that sort of thing. So that is a piece of law that was in place long before even sex offenders came to town.
Probably to follow up with that, I guess the best example I could give is Father Herrick had gone through application process to change his name. So that is a real possibility that people would want to do that, particularly having their names on websites and on the sex offender registry. That is a real possibility. But Herrick did try and do that and was stopped.
This question. Does the current sex offender residency restriction address sex offenders who work within 500 to 2,000 feet from a school or daycare?
Does it?
Yes.
I think I could answer that.
Okay.
If the question, if I understand correctly, is does it prevent a level three sex offender from working nearby a school daycare facility? No, it does not. And I think this is the irony. I'm not a particularly physically fit woman, But 500 feet restriction for residency is only a block and a half, a city block and a half. And even I could lope a block and a half before I got too winded. And so not only is there not a restriction, as Sheriff Dunning pointed out, on loitering near a school, there's no prohibition on working near a school, visiting near a school, driving by a school. The only restriction is residing near a school. And without any scientific merit to the idea that proximity equals safety, again, it is just obviously a feel-good law that's going to have very negative effects on the actual public safety.
I just wanted to add one comment. In the prior legislative session, there was a law that was enacted that restored voting rights for felons. Any sex offender having done their 2 years grace period would be able to vote. However, if their polling place was in a school, they probably would have a problem going through that process. So they would only be allowed to vote absentee only.
This question, who or what bears the responsibility for educating the public on sex offenders?
Well, actually, it actually isn't an education process that's mandated by law. It's strictly an awareness. It's a notification. And so the Nebraska Sex Offender Registry is that notification, or the VINE. I don't remember what that stands for now, but VINE is another avenue of that for notifying people so that you have the ability to go out and know who lives in close proximity to you. That's the only statutory responsibility. In fact, as I mentioned, all the things that our agency does, the only thing that we're really required to do by law is to register them and know where they're living. And that doesn't say how many times a year I need to check or what any of the other avenues that I mentioned that way do. So it's a fairly loose-knit law.
And I just add that I think is the saddest aspect of public policy that goes this direction of deciding that we will pass laws that we have no basis to think that they're going to help anything, but we pass those laws. And public policy, in fact, has left the obligation to educate the public, educate children and parents completely behind. There is no one entity that has the legal responsibility to do that sort of education. There are a number of entities that can voluntarily take it on. Our state attorney general's office followed up with a campaign about internet solicitation, for example, of minors. The attorney general's office certainly could use public funding to do a similar campaign on sex offender behavior. Sheriff Dunning talked about some of the programs that local law enforcement agencies across the state have followed through. But again, even the names of those stranger danger programs don't address the issue of what to do if mom or dad is the problem, what to do if Uncle Fred is the problem. And so those sort of education programs simply aren't happening unless parents choose to do that in their individual home, or if individual community worship groups, school educators decide to do that.
This is a question for both. Do you yourselves have children of your own? Shouldn't the protection of youth take priority over criminals, especially sexual predators?
I think, yes, everybody would agree that safety should be the paramount concern for the government. But deciding where someone can live or restricting where someone may live starts to affect core constitutional rights. And so even a criminal is going to maintain those constitutional rights unless the government can provide a substantial showing that the restriction on someone's constitutional right is necessary for public safety. Here, there is no showing, not even a sort of showing, let alone a substantial showing, that there's going to be any benefit in public safety. As for the personal question, I am not yet blessed with children. I, in fact, am a very proud auntie of very young children, and I worry about these sort of issues all the time, partly because, as a nature of my job, I have to think about sex offenders and have contact with sex offenders in a much higher percentage, I think, than the average person on the street. And so I do worry a lot about these issues and want to put children's safety paramount. But issues and laws that are passed with false safety simply aren't going to make me happy as a proud aunt.
Well, I have four children, but I guess they're not really children anymore. My youngest is 18, But she's actually living in a dorm setting, as did two of my other daughters at one time. And I guess I would have to say that maybe it's because I've been in this business for 35 years. I suspect everybody. I suspect everyone and trust no one. And that's kind of that's probably the attitude that I've given to them is to, you know, monitor things closely, always know your surroundings, going to and from jobs, going to and from classes, you know, make sure you're in well-lit areas when you're walking. If you suspect somebody's following you, go into a grocery store or gas station parking lot and lay on the horn as loud as you can and for as long as you can. I mean, all those sorts of things I feel that I have passed on, and I have passed on as the sheriff in making public presentations to elderly groups and women's groups and so on. So, yeah, I think I have done that, but I would agree that in something that you had said earlier that we really do need to do a better job about awareness campaigns for all three levels, children, their parents, and bystanders. So that's actually given me some food for thought because the drug dealers of the state have been very good to me in the form of seizure, and I think we'll probably develop something as a result of thinking about that.
Okay. Let's see. If I suspect someone of sexually abusing my child, what should I do? Should I confront the person I believe responsible, especially if it's a family member? Sheriff, I guess.
Well, I guess every situation is probably different. It's probably not a bad idea to confront. I would rather they go to law enforcement first, depending on the seriousness of the incident that they suspect. You know, a lot of times, a lot of these sexual abuse cases are family members or known associates of the families, and there's, you know, obviously going to be an immediate cover up if in fact that inappropriate behavior is taking place. So it's really best to go to law enforcement. We have some mechanisms available to us. Project Harmony is a very good agency that we use to give us a trained, unbiased opinion as to whether things are going on depending on the age of the child. So we do have some avenues to us.
Mrs. Miller, you use statistics quite effectively to demonstrate the wrongness of residency restrictions. Are you do you have any statistics to show that ignoring to be addressed with education, or is it a significant factor? Not real sure on that question myself.
See, my handwriting is poor too. That I think that if you were trying to read a question, so I'm going to sort of guess. I hope at what that question was. Statistics. I used statistics effectively. And is there anything to show that education would be the answer? Education is just one component, I think, that I've pointed out is part of the public policy debate that has not been taken up either in Iowa or Nebraska. Essentially, I think the most effective way to deal with the sex offender issues is treatment. And since both Sheriff Dunning and I were in agreement on that, we haven't spent as much time talking about it. But the statistics do show that treatment really is the key for being effective in dealing with individuals who have these behaviors. And yeah, the Department of Justice has said, I think, that it drops recidivism rates by 40% as soon as any type of treatment is there, and that the commonality that you find between people who have reoffended is they weren't currently in treatment or they had ceased their treatment or not participated in their treatment. So the public education component is important. But no, not any statistics out there on the education side, because in our fear and our decision to run towards easy solutions, we really have left that component behind. So there hasn't been adequate study or utilization of that method yet.
Sheriff Dunning, do you agree that so much reoffending by sex offenders is a myth?
I would agree that there is data out there that says that reoffending sex offenders is really a low percentage. I guess that doesn't take away from my responsibility, as I don't want to be in charge if and when it happens, so I have to do the best that I can to do more than I'm required to do. I still have a fear factor for the level 3 sex offender, particularly those that are of the sexual sociopath designation. So I'm required legally and morally to make sure I do more, all that I can do and more to make sure that people, particularly children, stay safe.
Questions for Amy. Do you feel delivery companies from FedEx to local pizza places can screen potential drivers for sex offenses?
That's an interesting question. That sort of takes it out of the area of my expertise. As a constitutional scholar, my knowledge is only about actions of the government. If the question is, can they screen, they certainly can to the extent of what public information is available. Background checks would reveal information. Unfortunately, I think for a lot of jobs, doing a full background check that takes in all states or federal offenses is very expensive, prohibitively so. Whether or not they are doing that, I think, is probably an interesting question because, again, that sort of points out the fallacy of these residency restrictions if you are allowing people to actually go into homes, you know, repair people, any other sort of job that actually allows people to approach or enter someone's home seem like those probably are vulnerable professions to someone who wants to abuse it as well. So legally, yes, employers can do background checks and check to see what's out there on the public information, but it is probably unlikely that any employer is doing that as thoroughly as they could. It's simply too expensive.
This next question, please define the various levels of sex offense.
You know, I probably can't do a good job of that because I can just tell you from the, as I mentioned earlier, we have 614 sex offenders in Douglas County, and I can tell you that we spend, of the time we spend on sex offenders, 99% of the time is spent on level threes, and that's really the only group that I'm actually concerned about. The other two groups, while we make sure that they keep the registrations active, we really don't pay enough we just don't pay enough attention to them because we just don't have time. Pardon?
What is level three?
Level three would be the group that has the highest propensity to reoffend, has had has demonstrated pedophilia or acts of a violent nature. Anything else you'd add to that?
I can only give you a brief description because it's been a while since I've looked at it. The level 1, level 2, and level 3 offenders are classified by the Nebraska State Patrol. Level 3 is designated as most likely to reoffend or most dangerous if they do reoffend. Level 2 then would be something along the lines of may reoffend, and level 1 are people who have committed a sex offense but have been deemed not likely to reoffend or not to be that dangerous. The way that the State Patrol comes to those decisions is through a testing instrument. The State Patrol, after someone is convicted, receives the pre-sentence investigation, the psychiatric evaluation of the person, the records that the police have on the individual, and then make a determination as to which category they should fit into. And the testing instrument looks a lot like those questionnaires you might see in a magazine. Was there violence involved? If yes, rate 5 points. If no, rate 0 points. And they simply go through those questions: how many victims, what was the age of the victim, what was the relationship of the victim. And after they complete that, they add the points together, and the points indicate whether they go into level 1, level 2, or level 3. Again, for someone like me, who's not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, some of those rating parts don't make a lot of sense. The State Patrol's rating instrument gives more points if the victim was male and less points if the victim was female. As a female, and given the number of sexual assaults there are against adult women, I find that a little disturbing that someone would be less dangerous because they chose me as a victim than that they chose Sheriff Dunning as a victim, although Sheriff Dunning would probably be able to defend himself more likely than I would. But, you know, again, I'm sure that there was a reason why they chose that, but as a layperson, I'm somewhat skeptical of the ratings. I spoke with a man who was rated as a level 2 offender because of the nature of his crime. He had just come in 1 point underneath what he would have been to be a level 3 offender. He'd had forcible sexual contact with an 8-year-old who was developmentally disabled. Now, I think most people who believe that sex offenders ought to be here, there, or whatever would say, well, that seems like someone that ought to be on a public website that we should be scared of. that that was a heinous crime. But because of the way that the rating instrument worked out, he was 1 point below, so he's not on the public website. You won't find him, and you won't be able to know that he lives next door to you. So I think there are some grave problems with the registry process, the underlying issue that leads us to where residency restrictions are that still are being fought out in the courts. Right now, of course, the United States Supreme Court has said that those sort of rating schemes have some scientists who have said they're adequate, and so they've been upheld by the United States Supreme Court thus far.
Okay, we're going to do this for the last question, this is for both. What about sex offenders' complaints that they will be effectively legislated out of living just about anywhere because the laws are getting so restrictive on where they can and cannot live?
Well, I think that's been asked and answered. I think that's that's a real possibility, and as I've said over and over and over, my fear of that process continuing is that these folks will go underground, and then law enforcement won't have an idea where they're at. I just can't believe that you're going to force somebody out of living and working conditions for very long, and that's going to be a real possibility, and that's I have a fear for that. So I'm hoping this effort that's taking place in the smaller communities will start to subside and give us the opportunity to use the tools the legislature just recently gave us to do some more extensive monitoring of level threes.
I do want all of you to witness the historic occasion when the ACLU and law enforcement stood side by side on so many issues. I'm personally thrilled. I'm hoping that I can get like a deputy badge or something. I think that that's absolutely true, that unfortunately sex offenders are going to be among us, and the question is, do you want to drive them underground? Do you want them not getting treatment? Or do you want to be able to be in a situation where sex offenders, like all criminals who've done their time, come back to the society and come back and live with us, work with us? If you want to effectively deal with public safety issues, you need to look for a more sophisticated answer than simply saying, don't live near me, don't live near my children, because that's not going to have any beneficial effect whatsoever.
I'd like to thank Amy Miller, Legal Director for ACLU, and Douglas County Sheriff Tim Dunning for taking time out of their busy schedules to participate in today's forum. We also thank our radio friends at KIOS 91.5. Next month, we're dealing with our noon forum, methamphetamine, its dangers and treatment. That will be Thursday, May 18th. We are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a discussion between Douglas County Sheriff Tim Dunning and Legal Director for the Nebraska ACLU, Amy Miller. Their topic has been where sex offenders can and cannot live. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, April 20th, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, May 18th at 12 noon at the Omaha Press Club. The topic, methamphetamine, its dangers and treatment, will be discussed by Jason Scott of the Nebraska State Patrol Commercial Drug Interdiction Unit and Dr. Todd Stull, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and Director of the University Drug and Alcohol Program. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.